do realize that this is our 420th episode, correct?
I do. I'm high as we speak. Yeah.
This is going to be great because I thought I'd just throw a couple of weed jokes at you.
Oh, good.
Just get your take, okay?
That's good. I have a cheeseburger and I'm ready to go.
This is from Tough Mama. And okay. I like to say right away, Tough Mom. Okay, it says, I just bought some shoes from my drug dealer. I don't know what he laced them with, but I've been tripping all day.
Okay.
That's
a dad weed joke for
sure.
Yeah,
that was, okay, how about this? How does a stoner recite Shakespeare?
I don't know.
To be or not to be?
And now for your listening pleasure, here's Polizzi and Rose, covering the week of media, marketing, and digital content news. This Old Marketing. Take it away, boys.
Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to This Old Marketing, proudly brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. And I'm Robert Rose, and welcome to episode number 420. That's right, smoke them if you got them. Episode number 420 for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. And with me, as always, as he always is my pal, my colleague, and a guy, probably the happiest guy, and that's opening day is coming next week for Major League Baseball, Mr. Joe Polizzi.
I'm very excited about opening day.
I can imagine you would be.
This is the first year I actually went to like real spring training. I talked about it with my son, did that whole thing. My team is the Cleveland Guardians.
Of course.
So they are always overachieving. The team just doesn't spend, they don't spend like your Dodgers.
No team does.
Well, I mean, like, the Dodgers Yankees, and maybe. The Dodgers and the Yankees, they spend more on one or two players than we do on our entire team. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Like, our best player is Jose Ramirez, and Jose Ramirez takes a hometown discount. He actually takes less money to play in Cleveland because they don't make him do anything. They're like,
right,
you don't want to talk to the press. You don't want to talk to the media. You're not known here, whatever, because he doesn't want to do that. And he's like, great, I'll stay in Cleveland. So that's the only reason we keep him. But anyways, very excited.
There you go.
Very excited. Are you, and you're not, but you don't care.
Not really. I mean, I'm a sort of a what I would call a sleepy Dodgers fan. I pay attention to the box scores. I like baseball and I read the box scores and I keep up with the soap opera, throughout the season, and then really start to pay attention when it gets to playoffs time. That's kind of it, right? I'm generally not that big a baseball fan, but when I am, I mean, look, I'm a Dodgers fan because I've been here, oh gosh, almost my entire life.
Like growing like moss on you.
Yeah. And I watched the game. What got to me to be a Dodgers fan was when I first moved here. I think it was the first or second year I lived here was the famous when Kirk Gibson sort of
hit the home run off of Dennis Eckersley.
Exactly. Yeah. And limped around limped around the bases. And it was, it was just sort of one for the history books. And so I became sort of a Dodgers fan after that.
Okay. So tell me this. I know you're not a big baseball fan, but I'm sure you've completed many brackets for March Madness, right?
I've completed exactly zero brackets for March Madness. Yes. It's not that I don't want to. I just haven't done it yet. Look, if there's one thing I know less than baseball, it's college basketball. That's for sure. Well, I know nothing about, and I really like watching college basketball. I just don't know anything about it.
You know what? So here's, I want to talk about something that's somewhat serious. Now, okay.
All right.
A few weeks ago, I didn't know who Caitlin Clark was. And now a day doesn't go by where I don't see something. It's like when you buy a mattress and then all you see is mattress commercials. Well, I've learned who Caitlin Clark is.
Why mattresses?
I don't know, because it was just President's Day.
All right.
And that's mattress holiday.
Oh, I see. Yes, indeed.
Anyways, so I like to fill out the brackets. And I fill out many, and I got the emails from a lot of different people, bracket, bracket, bracket. All men's NCAA March Madness brackets.
Yep.
And my astute wife just asked in passing, why isn't anyone doing women's brackets? Now, well, this is a thing. I know it happens, but I don't, like, on my Facebook feed or in other socials or whatever, you just don't hear a lot of people talking about the women's bracket, except maybe for, I hope Caitlin Clark makes it. Now, it's a big deal here because Cleveland has the Final Four, NCAA Women's Final Four, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. Yeah. So we're very, like, if Caitlin Clark makes the Final Four, I want to see her. I want to see her in person. I mean, I don't want to, like, go out on a date with her. I like, want to go to the...
You want to witness the greatness that
the
is...
The excellence that is Caitlin Clark.
That's right.
But anyways, I just... Don't you think that's odd?
I don't think it's necessarily good, but I don't necessarily think it's that odd. I guess it's really to be expected. I mean, until you start having, it is what it is at this point in history.
I know,
which
you
is,
don't have to go. We know why.
I would like to see it elevated more. I would absolutely like to see it elevated more because I've probably watched more women's basketball this year than I've watched in all the other years combined. And so I've become a little bit of a fan. But, you know, I mean, again, I don't know much about men's college basketball either. So it's, I'm a little in the dark, but the thing I like about college basketball in general, men or women, is that it's a bit of a slower game and you can actually see the plays develop and you can actually see the strategies being performed. As opposed to professional basketball, to me, always just looks like they're running up and down the field and shooting. Right.
I mean, it's kind of like the All-Star game this year. That was,
it's a little bit like that, right?
180 or something like that. Anyways, I'm excited about the women's Final Four more than the men's Final Four. And I almost, like, I wanted to put together a bracket. I don't put together brackets. I'm just part of them.
Here's the thing. Does the thing exist? Does a Google?
Can you Google? Absolutely. Okay. All right. You can do that. I mean,
the templates are out there. The templates are out there.
So that's my call. Like, if you, and by the time people listen to this, it's going to be like, there might still be time. Get your women's bracket together.
It sounds like they need some influencers to, like, make this a thing. They need some sports influencers to make the women's NCAA bracket like a thing.
Honestly, I think that we need better marketing on the women's side, especially the WNBA. I think
100% that's
absolutely true. Things can be done because they are amazing.
They are amazing.
People should go see them.
Yeah.
It's not there yet. It's almost like, it's a little bit similar with soccer too. Like, I can see it in the future. Like, soccer here in the United States is going to be the biggest sport in 35 or 40 years. You always think it's good. You're just biased because you like your American football.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of people who are predicting that the NFL long term is going to move to flag football. And I think that will be the end of the NFL. But
they're not going to. No, that's not going to happen.
I can't imagine that it would. But there's a lot of people who are predicting that that's where it's going. So,
well, I really believe. Have you seen the movie Idiocracy? Right.
Yes, I have.
That's what we're. I mean, at some point,
speaking of 420,
people going to be body slamming each other like on the streets, and this is going to be an okay thing.
Yeah, you may be right. We may be headed the other way, right? It depends on who gets elected in November.
Idiocracy is a future documentary of the United States of America, which I think is a Mike Judge film, right? Which is probably his best work. That's Beavis and Butthead, Mike Judge, but it's probably his best work is Idiocracy. In my opinion. We had a lot of things. We had the Don Lemon and
we had Don Lemon interviewing Elon Musk this week. That was a little weird. I think, by the way, the best marketing ever for Don Lemon in launching his new podcast and his new show. I mean, he's just got to be his PR people and marketing people just must be like over the moon happy about this.
I mean, so people don't know. Apparently there was some kind of deal where X Twitter Elon was going to distribute Don Lemon's show or clips of it for a 24-hour period of time, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then Don Lemon's first guest is Elon Musk, and they did the interview, and then right after Elon's people got in touch with Don Lemon's people and said, no mas, like it said contract canceled. Here's the thing, because I listened to Don Lemon's interview on Pivot, and here's what got me. It sounds like there was no written, like signed contract agreement.
It's yes.
Nobody will confirm that.
Right.
To your point, this is like the greatest marketing ever for Don Lemon. Like,
that's
unbelievable.
Right.
Everybody's talking about, oh, wow. I mean, the best thing that could happen is you get canceled immediately. Everybody's like, oh my God. And then your first guest is Elon Musk, and it's great. But Lemon's like, well, I don't know. I think maybe
I think you're onto something there. I mean, what I heard when I heard him being interviewed, and I've sort of watched from the sidelines, I thought there's a better than zero chance that this was all manufactured, not necessarily between him and Elon, but as I understand the storyline, right? Basically he was approached to do a show, non-exclusive, meaning they would just get some, you know, snippets of his show that would be exclusive, you know, some, you know, sort of behind the scenes content and extra content, but it would basically ostensibly be, can we run your show on X? Of course, you're going to pay me for another distribution channel. Yeah, great. Go, you be you. So no sweat off his brow otherwise. And then as a condition of that, they brought him out to CES to meet all of the, you know, sponsors and stuff for X to sort of trot him out as new talent, et cetera, that he, you know, that they've got real talent on X for these shows. So if I'm him, I'm like, huh, I don't care if I sign this agreement, don't sign this agreement. I'll tell my agents to sort of, you know, push it along. And I'll fly out to Vegas and do the CES thing and meet with all the people and make sure that I get Elon as my first guest. I'm going to get Elon as my first guest. Well, then, you know, that's fantastic for me no matter what happens. And so, yeah, I think it's really good marketing and PR and how much of it is manufactured is anybody's debate, but I think a lot of it was.
It's absolutely the best. And I would just say, I'll put the link in the show notes if people want to listen to it. It was right about the 30 or 35 minute mark where Don Lemon talks about being talent, being a journalist, but then moving and becoming a content entrepreneur, like being like creating the business model behind it and how difficult that was for him and how he didn't know anything about it and he doesn't have those kind of skills. And it was just, you know, you and I talk to people all the time about the struggles of being a content creator and the business side of it, and it's so much more than being a creator and sales and marketing and operations and everything. And it was just interesting to hear somebody from like Don Lemon talk about, oh my God, it's such a struggle to do this. So anyways,
What was interesting was, and I don't know if you caught it or not, but there was sort of a throwaway comment. He said, he mentioned one of his agents who is at UTA, which is one of the big Hollywood agencies here in town. And he basically said, sort of, you know, as almost a throwaway line, that agent was who taught him how to do this, right? How to set up a business and be a content entrepreneur, and mentioned that this agent has done this for others as well, other reporters and whatnot. And so there's a whole burgeoning industry happening at that sort of, you know, I don't know, call them A-list, B-list, you know, sort of, you know, journalists that are really in, many of them are moving to become content entrepreneurs that are doing ostensibly what Tilt is doing, right? Which is, you know, Tilt is doing it more on the sort of entrepreneurial business side, and they're doing it more from the journalist, you know, sort of media side, sort of helping these people understand what it means to be a content entrepreneur.
It just seems like, I mean, somebody asked me the other day, like how fast of a business growth area is creating your own little mini media business, becoming a full-time content creator. I don't have numbers on it. Nobody can just figure out worldwide, like how fast, but I would say it's the fastest growing business on the planet. It is the easiest business to start, and it is one of the hard. It's just like any other business, and we'll talk a little bit about it later. It is incredibly difficult to do because our media companies are crumbling around us. You have all this amazing talent, journalists, authors that are saying we can't rely on our formal, you know, our institutions, our media structures anymore. So we have to do it ourselves.
Yeah,
and that. So I love to see that. But it's very difficult to do it. Everybody,
it is. Knows. Well, and it's, you know, and what is becoming increasingly clear, and I'll talk about this when I talk a little bit about TikTok and the potential ban toward the end of the show, is how quickly many of those quote unquote small content entrepreneurs suddenly feel entitled that they can't have it taken away from them. Right. That
it's mine.
It's yeah. It's mine. It's yeah. You it's- owe me. Right. So
that's the thing. Actually, I know we have a show to do. I guess we're sort of doing it already. It amazes me how people that are on certain platforms for a long time and they build their audience think that, hey, that's mine.
Like, yeah, that's of course they do. Stuff. Right.
Like, and I get it. Right. It's like you put a lot of effort into it. You spend years and years and you're uploading videos or whatever you're doing. You have these followers. But man, I mean, you and I have been talking about this so long. I'm just used to the fact that I get up in the morning just like, oh, good. I still have my social channels.
Yeah.
But I always plan for, oh, they're not going to be there tomorrow, or they're going to kick me off, or the algorithm's going to be horrible and I can't get any traction anymore. I just think that we're headed that direction with most of the platforms.
100%. Yep.
But yeah, I'm interested to hear your take. So what else do we got going on?
Yeah, we've got a big show. We're going to talk a little bit about in our big story segment about how Apple and Google are discussing a deal to partner up for AI. All of you who thought maybe Apple would come out with their own AI, well, looks like Google is going to be the way that they want to go through this. We'll talk about some of the implications and ramifications of those kinds of things. We'll talk about the fact, you know, that Sports Illustrated, we talked about Sports Illustrated as a brand that was under duress, and then it was sold, and then it was an unsold, and basically a last minute beckoning by another company has saved Sports Illustrated for the moment. We'll talk a little bit about some of the content entrepreneurial aspects of that. Then OpenAI has opened up its content app store, and big surprise, shock of all shocks, it's beginning to be filled up with spam. So we'll talk about what's going on with
I'm
that.
I'm shocked.
Yes. And then we'll talk a little bit about authors and content creators and the gig economy. And is it bad for people? There's a couple of new developments in the author's world with regards to author's equity, a new business model that Joe will comment on, I'm sure. And then some people who are sort of looking at that a little side-eyed and saying, is this really what we want? And then we'll finish up with LinkedIn, of course, and we'll talk about how it's now really the talk of the town when it comes to the creator community and what's going on in marketing and content, and how somehow LinkedIn has sort of become the bell of the ball, as it were. In our hits and misses section, we'll talk about Liquid Death. I want to talk about Liquid Death, which is a great story about brand. Joe will talk about another Liquid Death, which is, of course, Coca-Cola. It's marketing strategy and what's going on there.
That is the real Liquid Death.
Yeah. Yes. And then in Rants and Raves, as promised, I will talk a little bit about the TikTok bill. I actually went out and read the bill
give yourself plenty of time to talk analyzed, about that. Like, yeah. I'll just defer to you at the end of the show and you, because you actually read the bill.
I did read the bill. It's not very long, but it does have some humorous moments.
Well, was it a 20-second video? I mean, come on.
It's there you go. And Joe is going to talk again about the content creator. Lots of content creator economy stuff in this episode. It's not just you. It's now super hard to make a living as a content creator. So chock-a-block, as it were.
Yes.
Chock-a-block. Mm-hmm. Full a cornucopia.
Very exciting show. Very
wonderful content.
Let's
cornucopia of content. My K's. I told you I'm high.
Cornucopia.
420.
Starts with a K? Is that? No.
No, yeah, it's just the K sound. It's the K sound.
It's a K sound. It's not a K sound.
Right. It's all C. Right? Anyway. All right.
Okay.
It's going to be one of those. All yes, right. Let's get to our first big story here. And it is coming to us courtesy of Inc. Three ways Apple's rumored AI partnership with Google should make your iPhone a whole lot better. This written by Apple's PR department. I'm sorry. No, it wasn't written by Apple's PR department. But anyway, the article opens up by saying on Monday, Mark Gurman at Bloomberg reported that Apple is in talks with Google to bring Gemini, its large language model that competes with ChatGPT, to the iPhone. The report doesn't say that any such deal is near done, and it also suggests that Apple has had talks with other AI companies as well, although other news reports are sort of reporting it a little more closed-ended than that. Google Gemini, of course, is the company's generative AI product based on a series of LLMs of varying sizes. It began life as Google Bard, only to have the company change the name earlier this year in an effort to simplify things, which didn't go quite as planned. That's my editorial insertion. Of course, things did go according to plan, says the article, and got more complicated, and Gemini started attracting attention for all the wrong reasons, which we, of course, talked about on this show. Yeah. And Apple is now looking to, looks like, outsource their AI development, maybe replace Siri with that. What do you think? What say you about all of this, and what do you think it portends for Apple getting into the AI game?
The first thing that I thought when I saw this, Robert, was Apple is further behind in AI than I thought. I don't know if that's correct, but that's the initial take, because this, I understand that they've outsourced search to Google, and Google pays, I think, between $8 and $12 billion a year for the right to be the search engine provider for Apple, which is amazing. And that's literally all profit.
That's
so they're going to do the same thing here with AI. And and the article goes through and says, wow, this is going to change Siri and AI's personal assistant capabilities. And theoretically, your iPhone will get a lot better. But the fact that Apple can't do this themselves, or they decided not to, is a really important decision. Now, that could mean that, great, if search is $8 to $10 billion, I have no idea how much the AI component of this and onboarding Gemini or whatever you do. I also thought that this was leaked by somebody at Apple so that we could get in a bidding war and get OpenAI and Microsoft and anyone else that has many billions of dollars laying around, so they could hike up these prices and get that. Yeah. I don't think it's a bad move for Apple. I mean, there's a precedent there with search. But honestly, we don't really know what AI features are yet. We're so early in this game. I would say if they do this, this is a shorter term deal. This is a 2-year deal, a 3-year deal. It's not ongoing. And it'll give Apple a chance to catch up, if you will, because it does seem that like they're behind. I don't know if you agree with that or that.
I do agree. And it also, I think, here's what I believe about Apple. So Apple has really smart people inside of it. And so you always ask yourself, what's the long game that they're playing here? And I think the writing is on the wall in terms of why they would do something like this, just to your point, which is about Google, right? But about search. They've printed money off of the partnership with Google on search because they really didn't even have to lift a finger. All they needed to do was literally put a search button on their phone and basically, become the biggest provider of mobile Google search that's out there.
I can't think of a bigger, more lucrative partnership in the world. Yeah.
It's just
there's $100 billion over the last 10 years. I mean,
that's right. And there was no way they were going to develop a search engine nearly as complex as as powerful as Google. So why even try? Right. Yeah. Why even go down that road, and why compete? Right. Because you're not going to compete certainly on the web. So there's no reason to compete on the phone. And so the interesting thing about that, though, is I think there's lessons to be learned about this, because what it suggests, and I may be going out on a limb here, but what it suggests to me is that Apple has realized that the development of where Gen AI and search is right now is probably at, sort of its peak is the wrong word, but sort of, you know, it's sort of that same sort of idea of, you know, it's kind of how quickly things move from six, you know, 0 to 60. And then it takes forever, you know, years and years for it to move from 60 to 61, right? So that evolution curve has flattened, and they look at it and go, Google's there, right? Google has, you know, all of the companies have gotten there. OpenAI have gotten there. Anthropic's gotten there. Certainly Microsoft has gotten there, as, you know, and certainly Google has gotten there with all of it. And so they look at it and go, there's no reason, you know, we could very quickly develop something that's just as good, but there's no reason to do that, because like search, why are we going to compete in an area that's going to basically be cutting each other's throats for the next few years, trying to get that extra incremental 1% better? So I think it tells me that they've seen that, you know, the whole AGI and sort of really, you know, exponential development of AI is probably slowed to a point where it's like, now is the time. Now is the time to get in with a deal with Google in this particular case. I see every reason for that, and basically make the deal, print the money for now. I agree with you. A short-term deal makes sense just in case somebody else comes out with something that's exponentially better. But it seems to me that they just don't want to be in that very crowded, very chaotic, very and highly competitive space that it's going to be, and that they're, you know, that they've given everything else, they'd put their money on Google.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just, again, surprises me a little bit, because I always thought that iOS on the phone would translate to the car and then to the home. And we would have, and so like, does
it still can, right?
It still can, but this is a critical part of it, because all these things have this AI assistant. I mean, you're basically creating these GPTs, if you will, for doing all these different tasks. And if you're then going to outsource that component as part of your iOS, it just seems different than search to me.
It is.
Where Apple was not playing and did not want to play.
I think you've got a great point, to which is, you know, the Apple has really prided itself over the last few years of being, you know, really focused on consumer privacy, right? So really closing down their ecosystem to where your data goes, and it's, I think, still unclear how that would work, right? With, you know, because the value of something like putting in a ChatGPT like interface is the ability for it to interface with my own personal data, my schedule, my contacts, my
know your behavior,
my internet of things devices in my home that are all controlled with Apple technology, and that theoretically, I guess, you know, and based on a promise from Apple, is all not available to, you know, the Googles and Facebooks of the world. The question is, does that data flow have to do, in other words, do I have to start giving permission for Google to have that data in order to make this new AI, like a new Siri or something like that? Do I have to make that work? And so I think it'll be an interesting balance for them to, even if it's just perception, right? That, you know, okay, your Siri's now powered by, you know, Gemini. And so, okay, well, where's my data going, right? Is it going to Google servers? Does Google have access to it? Can they target ads against me with that? Are you going to target ads with me to that? So there's a lot of questions that would still be out there. And that's the stuff that'll have to get figured out.
I'll make a football analogy for you. That this is what I think is happening. Uh-oh. They're not really, Apple was not really sure what they want to do with AI yet. They're in it, right? They're investing in it. So it's like they had a first round draft pick in the NFL and they decided to trade it away for this year. They're trading it to Google for $20 billion, and that buys them a year, and they can take that money, reinvest it, and come back the next year ready to go, whether or not they want to actually take that pick.
I think it's more, okay, so if you're going
to, you don't have to analyze.
If you're going
to
abuse this metaphor,
go on to the next story.
No. I think if you're going to abuse this metaphor, it would be more like they had a first round pick. They chose Google as the first round pick, but they only gave him a 1-year deal, right? That's the That's the right metaphor. Anyway.
No, I disagree, but okay.
Yeah. Hey, why, speaking of first round picks, let's pay a couple of bills.
Want to pay the bills?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, let's pay some bills. Here we go.
You ever wonder what unicorns eat for breakfast? All right, I don't actually know the answer to that, but what I do know is that 20% of all unicorn startups, they're using HubSpot, and for good reason. HubSpot's all-in-one platform levels up your sales, software, and support. Plus, they have a huge collection of resources to help startups scale, and with HubSpot for Startups program, you can save big off your first year. To see if you're eligible to save on HubSpot, visit HubSpot.com/startups. Want a cool new podcast for your commute? Well, let me give you a nudge. Yeah, that's right, Nudge. Nudge is hosted by Phil Agnew and focuses on how the smallest changes can have the biggest impact. It's a show with simple, evidence-backed tips to help you kick bad habits, get a raise, and grow a business. Every bite-sized 20-minute show comes packed with practical advice from admired entrepreneurs and behavioral scientists. Nudge is fast-paced, but still insightful with real-world examples that you can apply. Oh, and it's also the UK's fastest growing business podcast. Here's your nudge to get Nudge wherever you follow your favorite podcasts.
Are you familiar with a company called Notch? They help enterprise marketers drive business results with their content. Now, Notch is excited to invite you to their upcoming conference, Content Connect, a conference for enterprise marketing leaders using content to drive business results. You can join speakers from JPMC, Square, and Marriott, as well as your fellow content, digital, and analytics leaders for a day of keynote sessions, interactive workshops, and unparalleled networking opportunities. If you are interested in attending this free, did I say that right? Free event, please visit notch.com/content connect. We'll put this in the show notes, notch.com/content connect. That's KNOTCH.com/content connect. Be there.
It was, this show is brought to you by the K sound.
That was a lot of k sounds.
I guess there was
like the whole thing.
Oh my god!
And now
my...
because you did that in the beginning, and now everything is k. Everything's like cooks in the kitchen. Too many. Okay.
Ken is coming to kill me. Sorry, that's a Fish Called Wanda. That's a reference from Fish Called Wanda.
That's yeah. Tell me you're old without telling me you're old.
Okay.
Fish called Wanda.
Yeah.
Reference. Yeah. Exactly. All right.
Yeah. All right. We got a good story here. OpenAI has created their chatbot store, and big shock, filling up with spam, says TechCrunch. This is where this article is coming from. And basically the article opens up by saying when OpenAI CEO Sam Altman announced GPT's custom chatbots powered by OpenAI's generative AI models on stage at the company's first ever developer conference in November, he described them as a way to accomplish all sorts of tasks, generically and without saying anything. Sorry, that's my insertion there. From programming to learning about esoteric scientific subjects to getting workout pointers. Because GPT's combined instructions, expanded knowledge, and actions, they can be more helpful to you, Altman said. You can build a ChatGPT for almost anything. He wasn't kidding about that anything part. TechCrunch found that the GPT store, OpenAI's official marketplace for GPT, is flooded with bizarre, potentially copyright-infringing GPTs that imply a light touch where it concerns OpenAI's moderation efforts. A cursory search pulls up GPTs that support to generate art in the style of Disney and Marvel properties, but serve as little more than funnels to third-party paid services and advertise themselves as being able to bypass AI content detection tools such as Turnitin and Copy Leaks. Basically, no moderation has been found from the reporter who is here, and it says it doesn't require any coding experience, and basically it's just all sorts of problematic issues with copyright, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. Yeah, I mean, here I'll give you my quick take. I have not seen this browse this, you know, store since I actually I spent a weekend and created two GPTs that I talked about on the show, actually. Two GPTs, one which was supposed to be semi-useful, which I uploaded all the contents of my books and my blog, and basically made it sort of a content marketing FAQ thing where you could sort of ask me what I think about content marketing, and it would basically use my, you know, sort of my repository of blog posts plus my books as a means of answering that. Meh, it was fine. It's generally fine. I mean, it could say something about the depth of my knowledge. Yeah,
is that because of the content? Yeah, exactly. I mean, let's
yeah, I mean, but yeah, there's lots of ways to get into that.
Yeah, you got yourself.
The second, which was a little more fun, was I did a translation to Klingon, where you could actually, you know, translate your posts into the Klingon language.
That seems useful. That's
yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you're trying to learn to speak Klingon. You need sort of that, you know, interactive chatbot to help you sharpen up your Klingon. Yeah. So it always seemed to me that these were pretty commoditized from the very get-go, like without being able to access really interesting data and without being able to do like take actual actions and do like if then statements, then it was always going to be pretty limited to basically just a branded version of, you know, a white labeled version of ChatGPT that wasn't going to provide you with much more insight. But this feels like I'm shocked that this happened. It's like, you know, the surprising absolutely no one, this is what we've come to now, is a store full of spam. And I can't imagine how they fix it. I really don't.
Well, I mean, the key to any media company, social media company, as we know, is moderation.
Yeah.
And if you look at what Reddit this week is going public, Reddit is Reddit because of their power moderators.
Yeah.
Whatever, they got like 61,000 or something, some insane number that don't get paid, by the way, and do this and make Reddit what it is. And actually, Reddit has come out and said that they are the only true social media stock, or they will be the only true. And actually, there might be something to that instead of just getting fed media. But doesn't this remind you of the early days of Apple Marketplace, where it was just there weren't many restrictions, or what?
Well, there weren't many restrictions, but what restrictions were there kept it pretty safe. Right. In other words, Apple was, it was never a greenfield environment where anybody could just go in. I thought that
you were able to, in the initial days, you were able to get some more things by, and then they just, well,
sure. I mean, but that was just because nobody knew what the hell they were doing. Right. So there were some things that they would discover later, like, that's not, you know, like there were things early in the App Store where, for example, the early days of microtransactions, right? In other words, where you would buy, you know, you could upload an app and then include e-commerce functionality that you could buy extra levels, or you could buy extra things, or, you know, whatever you wanted to do. And in the early days, Apple didn't lock that down. And so when they did, there was, of course, a big uproar over that, and still is in many verticals. But they didn't have that locked down yet because they didn't have really the capability to facilitate those transactions and facilitate a fee off of those transactions. And so they were catching up with technology as much as anybody, you know, and that was going to, that those kinds of things are always inevitable to happen. But from a content perspective, it was always relatively well curated, right? It was Apple brand, right? So you weren't, and today it's very tightly curated.
Very tight. I'm just going to throw this out. So this is OpenAI, right? Wouldn't there be an AI moderation solution there that would be rather easy for them to create, at least at a cursory level? Right? Isn't this
maybe?
Aren't they like the leading AI company in the world? So why don't they just take care of it? Maybe they just don't care at this point. Maybe it's not that.
I mean, to me, it feels like they don't. This is an experiment for them. So they're just seeing. It's more of a, you know, it's more of an, you know, I what it reminded me of at the time when they launched it. Remember that thing we used to talk about all the time with Lego, where they had, it's a great program, by the way, an amazing program where they created a site where you could go pitch stuff. Your own product, right? What you, a product that you would buy, right? So they would say, you know, you could go on there and say, I want, you know, a Lego set that does the Death Star from Star Wars or whatever, you know, whatever it is you wanted to see as a product. And if enough people voted on it, and they would build it, they would actually build it. And it was, it's a genius thing, right? You know, basically build in demand before it even exists from your consumers, and then boom,
sounds
manufacture
like,
the thing.
Like content marketing, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So this reminded me a little bit of that, right? So see what really took off, you know, let open it up for people to develop stuff and let the creativity of the internet and crowd, you know, sort of take over, see if what floats to the top, and then go great and snap up the sort of cream of the crop and then close the whole thing down, right? So it still could be that, right? It could still very much be that, like they could see the performance of the things that actually are working, and then what's, and then by the way, just as valuable is to see the things that are absolutely not working, to give them insight in terms of the kinds of products that they should be developing or verticals that they want to go after, and do it that way, and purposely limit the functionality because of that, right? In other words, you've got to be super creative with the way that you do things. But what it's doing is, it's, you know, you're basically creating a situation where, you know, it's very much just the front end to other things that are being built, right? You know, so as I understand it, many of these apps are literally just front ends to, you know, all those things that you see on Facebook now, you know, create your avatar and make a cartoon out of your dog, and, you know, all those kinds of things that are quote unquote AI driven, but are literally just front ends to, you know, just processing.
Now, the project manager over the GPTs walked into Sam Altman's office and he said, "It don't matter to me." That was it.
There it is.
Let it go.
That was it. Yeah. I mean, you know, the crazy thing here is that it's not, I have to think this isn't great for the brand, right? I mean, we'll talk about brand later, but this is not, if I'm the brand guy at OpenAI, I'm not enjoying this one little bit.
There's no brand guy at OpenAI.
I know there's not. Yeah. I mean,
now you're just talking silly. Come on.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the next story here. This is a really interesting one. I found this story, and then honestly, I picked it thinking, because as I read it, I could only think about you and your business and what's going on in your business right now. So more than anything, I put this story in the show notes only so that I could get your take on it, because I really am curious about it. But here's the headline, comes from two sources, right? The first one we'll put in the show notes. This comes from lithub.com, and it's an editorial of sorts. The headline is, "Publishing models that rely on gig workers are bad for everybody." And this is written by someone named Morris Kreisman. And I'm assuming you don't know Morris Kreisman.
I don't know. No.
Anyway, so the article opens up by saying there are only two reasons to get into book publishing. The books, that's how they get us to formerly idealistic English majors. So it's this frustrated writer already. And the people, the other weirdos who also gotten by books. These people are famously overworked, underpaid, but they're still very much in it simply for the thrill of being part of the process of putting books out into the world. It's not much, but that little thrill is the backbone of the publishing industry. Which is why I felt the need, says the author, and I felt let down when I read a March 5th piece in the New York Times about a new company called Authors Equity. It consists of a supergroup of publishing veterans led by Madeline McIntosh, the former CEO of Penguin Random House, along with Don Weisberg, the former CEO of Macmillan, and Nina von Moltke, PRH's former president of strategic development, all of whom this author thought would value the enormity of the work that employees of major publishers do. And it appears this person was wrong. That then basically said, all right, well, I'm like, okay, what is that? I'd never heard of this author's equity thing. So the other that we'll put in the show notes is an article from the New York Times that talks about this new idea, which apparently is going to offer authors the lion's share of the profit, which is a new book publisher with an unusual business model, small footprint, and an outsized pedigree that includes some of the biggest names in publishing. The executives behind the publisher, Authors Equity, have run some of the biggest publishing companies. The new house is small, just 6 employees, but its founders hope that their experience and approach to publishing will attract writers. Contrary to the usual practice, Authors Equity won't offer authors money up front or guarantee them a payment, but will give them the lion's share of any profit that is made, according to Ms. McIntosh. It's a different kind of business model than the traditional book publishing model. Anyway, the article goes on in the New York Times to talk about how they would offer authors a share of the profits. They would pay them monthly instead of advances. They can do that over years. The books would be distributed by the classic, you know, Simon & Schuster publishing company, et cetera, et cetera. So it's sort of a pay, you know, basically your book pays for performance and they stop guessing on advances and all that. But anyway, as someone who now really works with business authors, especially, I found this very curious and would love to get your take on sort of this as a new business model, but maybe, you know, is it good? Is it bad? Is this basically, you know, the Uber, as it were, of, you know, of authors, or what's going on here?
Well, first of all, just in talking about gig workers in the publishing environment, I don't have any problem with, because I don't call them gig workers. They are contractors who own their own businesses.
Right.
It's just a different way. I just look at it a different way where, you know, at CMI for years, we worked with wonderful, amazing, talented people that had many different clients. And CMI was one of them. And that was fantastic. Now, I like my answer. My quick answer is I don't know what to make of this yet, Robert, but I have some takes. So Authors Equity, you know, I think Tim Ferriss and James Clear are investors in this. They're trying to come up with a different model than you talked about. So hats off to them to try to figure out how do we fix this broken system. The problem is, I think they're just trying to look a different direction, but they're still living in this environment where 0.1% of these books, they're like major Hollywood films. You get 0.1% that get made.
Right.
And they're big blitzes and they make everybody money. And then you've got movie rights and all these things. And then you've got the 99.9% of small books that are amazing, that are, you know, that creators and authors then distribute to their fans. And it's wonderful. And some of it is done directly, and most of it is done through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all that other stuff. I mean, I talked a little bit about this last episode with Kara Swisher's book. I guess what I want them to see, and maybe they don't see it, is the inevitable. Isn't it better that authors take control of the selling of their wonderful books and just sell directly and get these publishers out of the process? I understand. By the way, there's a role for publishers. There's a role for agents with these big, big projects that are like major motion pictures.
Yeah.
But in every other case, it by bringing in all these different pieces, that's not going to be profitable today. And if we are to have to leverage selling everything through, if it's selling the Simon Schuster, the publisher has to do it, or Amazon has to sell it, or Kobo has to sell it, or Barnes & Noble, whatever, they have to sell it. Everybody's getting a cut. It just seems more and more clear that the best way to do this is just help the author sell their books directly to their fans and call it a day. Again, not the one percenters, everyone else. And that's why I don't know if this is going to work, where maybe it makes more sense for an author's equity to say, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to give the author all the rights and all the royalties and not take any cut and just help them. And we've got these amazing freelancers and people that know the publishing industry to help them get their book out the door. That seems to make more sense to me than just everyone gets a little piece and everyone gets, we're going to share in the royalties. Bull crap. Have the author should get the royalties. The author did the work. Everybody else is just serving that author to help them get it. And they have their own little businesses too. So I don't know if I'm seeing this wrong yet. And I'm going to do a lot more research on what they're actually trying to do. But it just seems to be square peg, round hole to me.
I agree. The thing that stuck out to me was, oh, what they're basically, what this author's equity company is basically pitching is, you know, YouTube for print books. You know what I mean? It's basically you're a content creator. You can get a book done and you put it on their platform. And if you do great and you get a big audience and people read your a ton of your books, then you get a revenue share. And if you don't, you don't. So there's no cost to them. The problem that I see is that, you know, YouTube ultimately, without a marketplace, you know, which YouTube arguably is a video marketplace, and you search and you find and you discover new things that you might like through search, through the algorithm that is able to generate ideas for you to consume. And thus you become fans of things that you discover. Thus you become those things, if they're good, they build an audience. Without that sort of central marketplace of print books, which I didn't see anywhere in the copy that they would have, it literally just becomes, you know, it's just a different payment model, right? There's no innovation that's happening in the market space here. It's just we're, you know, our new business model is we don't give authors advances. I mean, that's it, right? Basically,
good for them.
You know, I mean, that's, and by the way, so many business book writers are like raising their hand right about now going, well, that's kind of the deal I got from my business publisher, from O'Reilly or from Kogan Page or from, you know, any of the other ones, right? That, you know, there's very rarely is there an advance given for these business books. You just get a percentage of the sales, and, you know, and you negotiate what you can negotiate, and you do what you do, and you can make audio, you know, you can make some money in audiobooks or something like that. But for these consumer books like that Simon Schuster are talking about here, it would be the same kind of thing. Yep. You would, I guess. And what is also not addressed here is how do they get new authors, right? Is it the same process? Like you literally submit your manuscript and you hope to get an editor that really loves you and wants to champion you? Or do they take everybody? They take anybody. Basically, they'll take anybody, and you're, you know, very much like YouTube. You just sign up for an account, submit your book, and start selling. And then they do a print on demand, which is not terribly different from what you're doing with Lulu, but it is different in the sense that you're there, like you say, it's there as a service to the author, not just a different kind of payment model.
And that's what we came to, like when we were looking, okay, we're going to create Tilt Publishing. We're going to create an imprint for nonfiction authors to help them get their books out. We looked at, okay, are we doing royalties? And it immediately became clear, no.
Yeah,
we're not doing royalties because we are not going to take any of that value away from the author. Let's just help them get the best book out they can possibly get them set up so they can sell directly to their fans and call it a day.
Yeah,
it's a different business model, mind you. It is not. I mean, and by the way, I mean, you and I are both McGraw-Hill authors.
Yeah,
were, because that division doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's gone.
They couldn't make it with the paying us something a little bit up front and then the whole thing and taking the rights and the royalties and the whole system. It just didn't work. And more of those publishers are going out of business. Yeah. So what's next? And I think this is just, they're just holding on to the past a little bit too much. And kudos to them. I hope it works.
It'll be interesting.
It just doesn't smell right.
Yeah. All right. Really quickly here, we're going to get to our hits and misses, where we talk about a big hit in the last week of marketing or a big miss in the world of marketing. And I'll jump in first here really quickly here because I have a quick hit, very quick hit, just a fantastic story. Last week it was announced Liquid Death, which of course is the canned water brand. And it is just canned water. It's just water in a can. Raised $67 million from a bunch of new investors, bringing up the valuation of the company to $1.4 billion. That's billion with a B, folks, for a canned water branded Liquid Death. Just say, look into that what you will. They're now selling $263 million in sales as of 2023. It's an amazing story, and it just speaks to the power of a great branding effort and putting in the time and the effort to really, really focus in on your brand and how you differentiate in the marketplace, because it's just water. But they're now doing, you know, they're right up there among the top water producers right now. So it's just a fantastic story.
I was at Gary V's event last year with my son, and I'd never bought a Liquid Death before. And that was the water. And I went up there, and I think it was like $10 for a can. And I said, it's water, right? Like, it's just
right.
There's water. There's not like alcohol. It's not a mixed drink of any kind. It's just water.
Yep.
Unbelievable. Hats off to them. This is incredible. Mine is really quick, too, because I was walking downtown Cleveland today. I actually had jury duty today. So I'm walking back and forth from my parking garage. And there's women's Final Four stuff everywhere, which is incredible. And Coca-Cola literally is everywhere you turn, every little banner. They've got a makeshift women's bracket in the middle of Public Square with Coca-Cola on it. I mean, they went all out activating this. And of course, Coca-Cola's got money. I'm glad they're sponsors of this. They're sponsors of both the men's and the women's. But I love to see when somebody sponsors an event and gets the rights, like the official NFL sponsor of water, and they actually spend the money on activating it. So kudos to Coca-Cola, you know, the other kind of liquid death, as you were saying, that they actually spent money. And I guess I'm just, you know, I'm in this place right now where I want to see more money put to the women's Final Four. So I like the fact that they did that. So literally everywhere I'm turning, it's Coca-Cola all over the place. So kudos to that team for, and when people come to Cleveland to watch these games, they're going to see Coca-Cola literally everywhere. And I'm sure they'll be giving out free samples of their liquid.
The free samples, and they'll build content off of it. You know, I remember talking to Jonathan Mildenhall 10 years ago when he was the head of creative at Coca-Cola, and he was talking about content and all the stuff that they were doing with the website, the Coca-Cola journey, and all the stuff they were doing on YouTube and all those kinds of things. And he was like, you know, when we sponsor World Cup or the NBA Finals, we get so much content that we can use that we could literally do a documentary for ESPN. Right. And so the amount of content and just ability to do more marketing by having that heavy of a sponsorship is just incredible.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Rants and raves. Very quickly here, we'll get to our rants and our raves, where Joe and I go off on a little bit of a rant or a little bit of a rave over something that makes us feel, well, makes us feel like it's opening day, or makes us feel like we're still stuck in some old season of something.
You should have. I thought you were going to do a 420 thing.
A 420. Well, we had a giant bong hit or something. Yeah.
Sounded like you did, actually. You were slowing it down.
Told you. Yeah.
Like I just had an edible. And
I could do my bong impression for you, but okay. Family show.
Mine is quick. I'm going to do mine at the end. I'm going to give you the floor.
Okay.
Let's you do the TikTok thing.
Okay. So TikTok, very quickly here, and there's a longer post on this that you can check out that I've actually outlined this stuff. I went out and read the bill. I went out and actually read the actual bill, which is 7521, the bill that actually, you know, is called the TikTok bill for whatever it's worth for you. And it says some specific things. And so what I wanted to do was I started seeing all this stuff, this alarmist stuff. Like, there's a ton of stuff out there right now with TikTok videos and people on social media going, even if they wanted to sell, they can't sell because Chinese law doesn't allow them to export technology. And oh my God, the world's coming to an end and it's all going to die. There was literally a TikTok video of a guy in tears, like, I can't believe you're going to take away TikTok. TikTok is so important to small businesses. You know, I mean, it's getting a little much. And so that sort of let's just take a look at what's going to happen, because nothing's going to happen here. Read the bill. Basically, point number one is, could you even enforce a ban, right? How do you enforce, like, banning an app, full stop, you know, through the web, through mobile, how do you do that? Well, actually, the bill doesn't ban TikTok. It bans anybody who would distribute TikTok. So in other words, they wouldn't go after ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok.
Apple and Google.
They would actually go after Apple and Google and Oracle and Verizon and AT&T and anybody who distributes it. The fascinating thing here is that it's $5,000 per user per offense. So, so if there's 100 million current users in the U.S., so that's a $500 billion potential fine, which is just ridiculous. It's just silly. So it's just the other thing in there, that, and nobody's talking about this on the mainstream media, is the other big part of this bill is the data. So they say, regardless of what happens, if TikTok sells itself or doesn't sell itself, ByteDance or whoever owns it has to give users access to an export of every single bit of data they have about them. The username, the images, the text, the videos, anything they've uploaded, anything they've gotten, they have to be able to access with that. And the penalty for that is $500 per user. So that's a really interesting thing to, for us to follow if this thing even gets any kind of movement. Who would buy it? The fascinating thing to me is the bill doesn't actually, you know, there's Steve Mnuchin is maybe going to put together investors to buy. People have said Microsoft might buy, Google might buy it, Apple might buy it. But the actual thing says, doesn't specify. It only specifies that it can't be controlled by one of the five, you know, uncool sort of foreign adversary countries, which is China, and that includes Hong Kong, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Russia. So, you know, my vote is that Ryan Reynolds, our beloved, dreamy, wonderful marketer, he can come in from Canada and buy TikTok. That's what I'm voting for. I'm going to have Ryan Reynolds come in and buy TikTok. I'm looking for you, Ryan, out there to actually get TikTok bought. Anyway, they have time. That's the other thing that's in there. It's 6 months. So even if it banned tomorrow, they would have 6 months to find a buyer before it would actually be banned. And even if it's not found a buyer within 6 months, they can come back anytime. In other words, they could come. So Ryan Reynolds could come back after 12 months and go, I'm going to buy TikTok, and then all would be well again. So they've got plenty of time to let this play out. And then it's fascinating. They actually name ByteDance by name in the bill. You know, I mean, look, there's no other, like, you know, there's no other viral video platforms from North Korea or Russia right now that are burning up the charts. So, you know, it was pretty much always going to be about TikTok, but they actually name ByteDance and TikTok by name. But then they actually call out an exception, and they call out an exception for platforms that provide user reviews, product reviews, or travel information. And I kept trying to figure out who the hell was that written for? Like, that was, it's too oddly specific for them not to have somebody in mind with that. Don't know who it is. Can't figure it out. And so finally, I'll just mention this, which is with regard to the conspiracy theories that are going around, like, but ByteDance can't. So even if it wanted to sell, it can't, because they're citing this Chinese export law that basically is called the Catalog of Technology, which to me sounds like a Harry Potter novel. But basically, it's this catalog of technology that cannot be exported from China. It includes things like, you know, LIDAR and, you know, crop science and, you know, all those kind of social media algorithms are not part of it, to be clear. And by the way, ByteDance is not owned by the Chinese government. It is owned by some Chinese founders, some international investors, 7,000 American employees also have ownership of the company. So the Chinese government has 1%, what's called the golden share in China, which gives them a board seat, basically. So yeah, they have some influence. Yes, it probably does need their permission in order to sell the company, but it's not prohibited by Chinese law, and it's certainly not prohibited by some of their export tariffs or anything like that. So is it likely to be sold? No. I can't, like, after reading this, I'm like, no, there's this, because the other thing is, this bill's going nowhere. This bill's going nowhere. Senate's not going to pick it up. Senate's, if they do, they'll completely rewrite it into something different. Yep. Certainly not going to happen before the U.S. National elections. So it's going to be punted down the road to for the next president to deal with. And I would doubt that. I would forecast some sort of deal happening where they, you know, make it even more stringent with Oracle or do something with their Texas project or whatever it is. This is, we can all just take a big deep breath about TikTok. It's not going anywhere in the near term.
Yeah, I think there's probably some regulation that's going to happen, but it won't be banned. And the other thing that's just interesting with this is that whoever, if Mr. Trump becomes president again, he was the one that really got out on this when he was in office about banning TikTok.
Yeah,
and now he's switched.
Oh yeah, of course.
He's okay with it now because he hates Zuckerberg more, and one of his big contributors is also a part owner of ByteDance. So kind of weird, Kind of weird. I'm not saying anything. It's just weird. It's just a thing.
It's just weird. It's just odd. We're just asking questions. We're just asking questions.
Thank you for your service, Mr. Rose.
Oh, thank you. No, it was fun. It was actually necessary. It was actually fun.
You and three other people read that.
Ryan Reynolds. I'm glad. Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds.
That would be. Oh, now not Steve Mnuchin. Ryan Reynolds could put a group of investors.
Canadian group. I think I want to see them put together a Canadian group.
Nice apologetic group of.
Yes, exactly. With all sorts of Canadian companies being, you know, and it becomes TikTok, eh?
Oh, you were waiting for that. You were waiting for that.
I was.
I'll give that to you. That's pretty good. Yeah. Okay. So mine very quickly. I put this on the screen here. I'm gonna link this in the show notes. This is a really great, thoughtful article on LinkedIn from Alexis Grant. Alexis is actually speaking at CEX, going to be interviewing Justin Welsh, but her article is called "It's Not Just You, It's Harder Now to Make a Living as a Creator." She puts some real thought into this. I don't want to break the whole thing down, but I did give a response to this in LinkedIn, and I'm going to read the response because I think it'll be indicative of what she was getting at. So basically I say, first, Alexis, it takes a long time to become a success as a content entrepreneur. Our research at Tilt shows it takes about 18 months to start making money, but I truly believe that number is 3 to 4 years. And guess what? That's pretty much just like any other small business. Second, I know hundreds of creators personally who are doing exactly what you say. They are selling the idea of content creation. I do this as well. While Justin Welsh and Jay Klaus types have broken through, most won't. And how many people do you need selling online the same stuff? Thousands of people are selling the same stuff the same way. Not everyone's going to break through and build an audience. It's just not going to happen. And then my point is, I would like to see more content entrepreneurs figure out possibility of older B2B areas like niches in manufacturing or operations of the business of food or engineering or something like this. But really, what she focuses on, which I think she's right, Alexis talks about it's not just the content creation. It's not just the building the audience. The most important thing is, can you market and sell it? That is the key, like the key missing. And I wanted to get your take on this, Robert. I think she's right, because we see so many people out there that have built audiences that can't survive. It's the selling and the marketing and the packaging of that makes it work.
Well, that's what always makes it work. Right? I mean, Liquid Death is the perfect example of that, right? It's the same with any product, right? It's all about how, you know, it doesn't matter how good the product is. It doesn't matter how good the product is if it's not marketed well, or if it's not marketed clearly, or if it's not marketed even, you know, I will always come back to, you know, the famous Jean-Luc Picard, who said, you can do everything absolutely perfectly and still lose. And so there is absolutely a timing here and luck, in terms of success that play into this, that not the best product will always win. And so all you can do is continue to try and differentiate and continue to try and pierce the noise. And it just becomes, to your point, it becomes very difficult if you're talking about something that everybody else is talking about. It's way easier when you're the only one talking about a particular thing and that thing becomes popular. You know, people forget that Paul Reitzer and Marketing AI Institute existed for 2 years before it became like a hit, a huge thing, right?
Well, it started on it, I think, back in 2014.
Yeah.
So, I mean, 10 years ago was really on the cutting edge of figuring this stuff out.
And so... It's sort of like 10-year overnight success, right? Where you've got to, you know, there is a bit of everything involved in sort of becoming breakout. And the question is more, and I think this gets to everything you teach, which so wonderfully, is it's having the ability to have that perseverance to become success, to become viable, right? To become viable. And then beyond viable, it's mostly luck and context and timing.
Yeah, it's if you're not thinking 3 to 4 years, you're just not thinking right. Now maybe you'll be a one percenter and you can make your money and hit it big inside of a year. I mean, Mr. Beast, it took him 5 years.
Yeah.
It wasn't making money yet, but 5 years to get to an audience where he could start to monetize it.
Yep. And every single one of those people that you've ever heard interviewed, at least everyone I've ever heard interviewed, they all say the same thing. We had no idea what we were doing. We were doing the best we could with an idea that we were passionate about. And there was no, they weren't following some templated playbook. They were consistent. They were certainly using best practices, but they were finding success through, you know, the perseverance and through the persistence and through the consistency and through just being there, you know, showing up every day, like you said, for sometimes years. And that's what got them to success. There was no magic bullet.
Well, and then we started kicking around content marketing in 2007.
Of course.
It really started, really took off maybe the end of 2010 and 11. And then we saw this upward trajectory. But if we start, Content Marketing Institute started officially in 2010. If that would have been 2012, I don't think we would have made it. I really don't. I think from your idea about timing.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, I'm not sure I would say 2012. I mean, maybe 2015, because at some point it would have, it's an idea whose time came, right? I mean, that content marketing in many ways was already there. It was just sort of bubbling underneath the surface, you know, there was article marketing and then there was inbound and there was all these things that were sort of happening
custom
in the 2008
custom social media, custom journalism.
Yeah. So it would have happened. We just caught lightning in a bottle from a synthesis standpoint and sort of turned it into something that people could grab onto and hold. So that timing was very, very important, but there was also the persistence of work as well too.
That's right. Well, it was 3 years and I almost gave up and you talked me off a ledge. So, I mean, thank goodness you were there. You were my friend.
Oh,
I'll never forget that. Wait, this is episode 420. I don't know why I'm saying these things.
I'm super high. What do you got?
I'm high on you, baby.
You got jury duty this week. What else you got going on?
I do. I don't know how long this is going to take, to be honest. I'll know tomorrow. It could be very quick, the case that I'm on, I've been said it could go until next Friday.
Yeah.
So,
he has not seen the show Jury Duty. So I have encouraged him to go watch the Netflix show Jury Duty so that he can get embedded in that. But
anyways,
you who have seen it will know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'll check it out. But again, spring pricing for content.
Oh, there you go.
Expo is ending next week. Use the code TOM, TOM100. So you get a chance to be on our live show
and you're sexy.
DX. And what do you got going on?
Get your sexy on. Working. It's become a busy time and I'm of course getting my presentation ready for CEX because I'm looking forward to that and enjoying some of the spring weather that we have here in lovely Southern California.
That's good. Good for you. Yeah. Happy there we for go. You.
All right, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back again next week with another regular old episode of This Old Marketing. And until we see you again, well, just remember, why don't you get out there, give us a review, give us some reviews, give us some follows, give us some all the things, just get us some stuff, wouldn't you? And in the meantime, until we see you again, remember, everybody, it's your story to tell. Tell it well. We'll see you next week on This Old Marketing. Thank you.